Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are always in the know. And you can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Ladaris Hazard Cordell, a retired California State Court judge, a former Stanford University vice provost, and currently the independent police auditor for the city of San Jose, California. And I am your moderator for today's program. We are honored that Randall Kennedy is here with us in San Francisco today. Since 1984, Professor Kennedy has been on the faculty of Harvard Law School, where his scholarship has focused on how racial issues interact with legal institutions. He encourages his students to view difficult subjects from all perspectives, be it constitutional law and freedom of expression, legislation on civil rights issues, or race relations. Professor Kennedy is the author of 6 books, including his most recent, For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. Now, what makes him unique is his willingness to tackle hot-button racial issues like affirmative action or interracial marriage and adoption, and his insistence that we not shy away from the awkward discussions that inevitably arise. Randall Kennedy was born in Columbia, South Carolina, and raised in Washington, D.C., by parents who insisted that he and his 2 siblings each find one thing about which to be passionate. He chose tennis, and he received a tennis scholarship to St. Albans Preparatory School. Professor Kennedy and his siblings are all Princeton graduates. He was awarded a Rhodes Scholarship to study at Oxford University and earned a law degree from Yale. He served as a law clerk on the U.S. Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit, and at the United States Supreme Court, where he clerked for Justice Thurgood Marshall. Professor Kennedy's wife and physician, Yvette Matori, died in 2005, and they have 3 children. Please welcome him, and I advise you all, hold on to your seats, because you're all in for a very interesting ride. Professor Kennedy. Hello, my friend.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much for the generous introduction, and I'd like to thank our hosts for making this forum available to all of us. My latest book is For Discrimination, and it's a book about the affirmative action controversy. It's a book about the history of affirmative action, about the law of affirmative action. It's always a question, how do you start a book? How do you get going with a book? And I decided this time around to begin the book with a memoir, and I'm going to spend just a few minutes talking about the introduction to the book. The book is called, the introduction is about my interactions with affirmative action. I figured that readers might be interested in my own experience with affirmative action, so I decided to discuss it. I was born in 1954 in Columbia, South Carolina. I left Columbia when I was very young. I left when I was about 4 years old. And I once asked my father why we left. And he told me that he wanted to leave because he thought that if he did not leave Columbia, South Carolina, either one of 2 things was going to happen. Either he was going to kill a white man, or a white man was going to kill him because of the situation in the Deep South in the 1950s. So we left, and I grew up in Washington, D.C., but I went to South Carolina often. I spent summers there. I spent holidays there. And in Columbia, I saw the end of the Jim Crow era. In fact, at the very beginning of the book, I talk about one of my most vivid memories of South Carolina. And it was, this memory involved going to see a movie, The Nutty Professor, starring Jerry Lewis. And I was 9 years old, and I remember seeing this movie. We went in the with my cousins. We went in the side door, which is where, you know, the colored people went. And we sat up in the balcony, which is where the colored people sat. And from the perspective of a nine-year-old, I thought that this was just great. I thought this was great because, you know, from the balcony, you could get candy and throw the candy on the people below. And it was much more difficult for the people below to throw candy back. So, frankly, I thought that this was a, you know, we had a strategic advantage being in the balcony. Well, I mean, other parts of Jim Crow were not so happy. I mean, I remember in the summers of 1962, 63, 64, all of the parks in South Carolina, all of them, were closed because the authorities decided to close all of the parks rather than desegregate them. So I was a kid, and you know, there were parks all around, but you cannot go into the park. Well, I say that just to indicate that I am very much aware of the way in which invidious racial discrimination has directly touched millions and millions and millions of black people in the United States. And one of the things I emphasize when I talk with my, you know, students, because sometimes when people talk about invidious racial discrimination, especially young people, think that, you know, this was, you know, a part of history that is really quite remote. And if you talk about, you know, the Jim Crow South, I look at some of my students, you'd think that I was talking about when the, you know, when the era of the dinosaur. And I have to say, you know, this was not long ago at all. This was a moment ago. So I've seen that. But I've also seen another aspect of the race line in American life. And in fact, most of the introduction is about the way in which the affirmative action ethos, that is to say, the use of race as a way of reaching out a helping hand, a friendly hand to African Americans, has been an important part of the story of the United States over the past 30 or 40 years. And I talk about the way in which this has affected me. In the introduction, it was mentioned that I went to St. Albans School, a wonderful school, a great school. I was the beneficiary of a tremendous amount of solicitude at St. Albans School for a variety of reasons, but certainly one reason was because there were teachers there who saw it as part of their mission to help promising young black students. And they were, you know, they were wonderful teachers. They were attentive to all students, but I think that they were especially attentive to me and the few other black students that were there. It wasn't just, that didn't just happen at St. Albans School. From St. Albans School, I went to Princeton. At Princeton, I was helped very much by a person. Well, he was the president of Princeton then, William Bowen. And Neil Rudenstein, who was the provost at Princeton, he later became the president of Harvard University. I think for these people, part of their mission was to advance the fortunes of young black intellectuals. I dedicate this book to two professors I met at Princeton, the great historian Eric Foner and the great legal academic Sanford Levinson. And again, I think that, you know, part of they saw as part of their mission, they were on the lookout for young black people who they could help advance. Just one other example. I've taught at Harvard University now for 29 years, how the years go past. 29 years. I've loved it. I was not, when I was ending my time at Yale Law School, I was not headed towards legal academia. I was headed towards a job at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. One day when I was a third-year student, the phone rings in my office at the Yale Law Journal. It's the dean of the Harvard Law School, James Vornberg. He says, listen, I'm Jim Vornberg, I'm dean of Harvard Law School. Have you ever thought about teaching? I said, no. He says, well, think about it. Tell you what, if we send you a ticket, will you come up to Harvard Law School and, you know, talk with us about it? I said, sure, I'm game to talk. And they did. And over the course of the next 18 months, they talked me into becoming a legal academic. And that's how I became a legal academic. Very unusual. And Harvard Law School does not typically ask people to, you know, apply for a job for the faculty. It's very unusual. But they did, and certainly one of the reasons that they did was because they wanted to bring to the ranks of Harvard Law School more people of color. So this, I am an affirmative action baby. I have been helped by affirmative action throughout my career. Affirmative action has been deeply vilified in the United States. I needn't have to really emphasize this to a California audience insofar as the good people of California, by voter initiative, nullified racial affirmative action. And I thought it was important to begin a book on affirmative action by putting a face on it and by saying just straight out, I'm a beneficiary of affirmative action. I'm not angst-ridden about it. I'm not guilty about it. I don't feel bad about it. I think I have been benefited by it. Are there costs associated with affirmative action? Yes, there are costs associated with affirmative action. But I think that the benefits far outweigh the costs. And I think that I'm a person like many, many, many African Americans who have been benefited. And I would say that, you know, the benefit is not just a personal benefit, though it is a personal benefit. But I like to think that I have put to good use the efforts that have been made on my behalf and put to good use these efforts not only for myself, not only for my family, but I hope that I have helped through, you know, my own efforts the country a little bit, done my little bit to help the country move to a better place with respect to race. And race relations over the past 30 to 40 years. With that, I'm going to subside and let's turn the monologue into a dialogue.
Wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I have to tell you, I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with you today, and I really gave a lot of thought to these questions. I read the book, and I encourage you all, if you've not read it, please do read it. There are some things in there that I will tell you as I was reading it. I had these moments where I went, oh, no, he didn't. What? Did he write? What? And then I'd read a little more and get a far different, sometimes different perspective and take on affirmative action. So with that, let me kick it off with this question. Mm-hmm. And again, I remind you, you can write your questions on cards. And if you have any, you just signal that you have them and someone will collect them. All right. So here's my first question. I'm going to give you three short quotes from the book. And then ask you a question about it. Here's the first quote. Many such affirmative action programs are race conscious right beneath the patina of their apparently raceless packaging. Affirmative action disguised in plain sight are racial neutral policies that make no mention of race but are all about race. Mm-hmm. And finally, you write, packaging matters. So let's talk about the packaging of your book. You have chosen to call it, and I notice it's underlined, for discrimination. So not for or in favor of affirmative action, but for discrimination. So the message that I got conveyed from this title is that affirmative action is discrimination. Mm-hmm. And maybe it is. But doesn't your packaging it this way hurt the cause of those who are fighting for affirmative action. So if you, as you say, packaging matters, why did you choose this packaging?
Mm-hmm. Couple things. First of all, the title, which I've really come to like, was recommended to me by my editor. So I wrote the manuscript. I had a long, awkward, working title, and it was time to, you know, have a real title. And I was having difficulty, and my editor, Errol McDonald, suggested For Discrimination. And initially I was resistant because, of course, when you think about the word discrimination, it often has a negative connotation. And so I was initially resistant, but over time I came to embrace it, in part because I think it's important. Affirmative action is a type of discrimination. And I think that people who are pro-affirmative action don't like that because it gets, you know, if you say discrimination, it gets really close to that bad sort of discrimination. But I think it's important to say, listen, there are all sorts of discriminations. There is such a thing as positive discrimination, affirmative discrimination. That is, in my view, good. And that is to be distinguished very sharply from invidious discrimination. We ought to be mature enough and thoughtful enough to recognize that you can have good discrimination and bad discrimination. I do not want through. I'm happy to deal with the claim that, you know, affirmative action is a type of reverse discrimination. So in my title, I was courting a problem, people taking a double look, but, you know, I'm willing to face that. There is this other thing, though, because, you know, I've written a number of books with titles that have generated controversy and opposition. One of the things you want to do when you're a writer is have a title that will prompt a second look. If you write for a newspaper, you want that headline that's going to prompt a second look. If you write a book, you want that second look. After all, you go into a bookstore, there are thousands of books. You're screaming to get the attention of readers. And so this title, I think, does that in part because people aren't used to seeing the word discrimination viewed in a positive way. And so it raises a question, and raising that question is sort of what you want.
So this is consistent with the shortest book you've ever written, which has probably created the most stir. Mm-hmm. And the title of that?
The title of that was Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word.
Right.
Yeah.
So you are being consistent. So let's move on to the Supreme Court, because you talk a lot about the Supreme mm-hmm. Court in your book. And one of your criticisms of the U.S. Supreme Court, I'm going to quote from your book, "The Supreme Court has wrongly rejected societal discrimination as a basis for racial affirmative action. A central concern is the unfinished business of rectification. At the oral argument of Fisher, there was no discussion at all of historical, invidious racial discrimination and no allusion whatsoever to Sweat versus Painter." Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, would you tell us about the compelling story of Hem and Sweat?
Yeah. Well, in 1950, the Supreme Court of the United States issued a very important ruling. In fact, it was the ruling right before Brown versus Board of Education. It led right to Brown versus Board of Education. The question was whether there was a post office man, black postal worker, Hem and Sweat, who applied to the University of Texas Law School. And the dean of the University of Texas Law School wrote him back and said, and congratulated him on his record, said that except for one thing, he was perfectly qualified to be admitted to the University of Texas Law School, and said the one problem was that he was black, and therefore he could not come to the University of Texas Law School. So Sweat sued, and he won his case. Now, this is 1950. Again, this is not long ago. And the fact of the matter is that even in the 1970s, the University of Texas system was still being found to be in violation of the United States Constitution in various ways with respect to the admission of Latinos, the admission of blacks. But last year, in Fisher versus the University of Texas, Fisher was a white woman who was suing the University of Texas. She was disappointed she didn't get the University of Texas. She said she was the victim of reverse discrimination. That's what the case was about. In this case, the Supreme Court of the United States, in its majority opinion, doesn't even mention Sweat versus Painter. In my view, it's absolutely remarkable. We need to mention another case closer to home. It's a California case. 1978, University of California, Davis Medical School versus Bakke. The most important affirmative action case in higher education. It's often viewed as a victory for affirmative action because at the end of the case, the key decision was Lewis Powell's decision, and he said that you can take race into account consistent with the United States Constitution if it's for purposes of diversity. But he also said you cannot properly take race into account for purposes of trying to redress societal discrimination. I thought that that was a terrible mistake on his part and on the part of the Supreme Court of the United States. I mean, why can't you? Why isn't it a sufficient justification to say that we want to redress the ongoing scars of past discrimination? And it's for that reason that there were other problems I have with the Supreme Court, but I think in the affirmative action context, that's probably my central complaint about the Supreme Court's jurisprudence of racial affirmative action in higher education.
And in the Fisher case, it isn't as if the justices maybe not, it was an oversight, not citing Sweat. A brief, an amicus brief, was filed.
That's right.
In the Fisher case, about Sweat. Right?
Very poignant. The relatives, Sweat's deceased, but the relatives of Heman Sweat wrote a brief about his experience and about the fact that he withdrew from the University of Texas Law School because even after he was admitted, he ultimately had to withdraw, he was ostracized, he encountered all sorts of difficulties there. It's even more poignant, though, than that the justices didn't talk about his case. His relatives have a lawyer write a brief, and even that brief refused to push the case of societal discrimination. And it's understandable why they didn't. The lawyer knew that the Supreme Court had basically said, this is verboten. This sort of argument is off the table. And so they didn't make the argument. And I think that's a mistake. You know, the Supreme Court changes over time. The Supreme Court now might not be open to that argument, but that's not to say that in 5 years, in 10 years, it won't be open to that argument. So I want people to know that this is an argument that ought to be made. And I want people to be able to make that argument so that maybe when we have a different Supreme Court that's a bit more open, that argument can be made and will reach receptive ears.
So let's stick with the Supreme Court, and I'm going to mention the name Clarence Thomas. Now, Clarence Thomas's profound animosity toward affirmative action is widely known. And here's one quote by him that you put in your book. This is Clarence Thomas speaking. That these programs, affirmative action, may have been motivated in part by good intentions, cannot provide refuge from the principle that under our Constitution, the government may not make distinctions on the basis of race. Mm-hmm. And you write in your book, and this is a quote from you, Thomas was handsomely rewarded for repudiating affirmative action. So why is Clarence Thomas, himself a beneficiary of affirmative action, so antagonistic? And what is your response to his assertion that the Constitution prohibits any racial discrimination or distinctions?
Okay. Well, I mean, Justice Thomas is ideologically conservative. There are, you know, the black community is a varied community. And there are black people who are liberals. There are black people who are leftists. There are black people who are conservative. I would call Justice Thomas an ultra-conservative. But, you know, the black community is varied like other communities. And so I don't think it should be a big surprise that there would be black people who, you know, would take the position that he takes. And fine. Black people come from things in a wide variety of, you know, they have a lot of different ideological positions. So he's very conservative in a wide range of ways, culturally, ideologically, you know, politically, other sorts of ways. There are some people who, in criticizing Justice Thomas, have criticized him and said he's morally obligated to support affirmative action since he has been a beneficiary of affirmative action. He says that he says that he has not been a beneficiary of affirmative action. I think that is laughable. I don't think there's anybody in the United States, frankly, who has been more a beneficiary of affirmative action than Clarence Thomas, ironically. I mean, was it just accidental that Clarence Thomas took the position of my old boss, Thurgood Marshall? Was it just accidental that the first black associate justice of the Supreme Court retires and that Clarence Thomas, another African-American, takes his place? I mean, was that accidental? Of course it wasn't. It was a part of a political calculation by President Bush. You know, the fact that Clarence Thomas was black had something to do with his being elevated. Okay. Now, by the way, a little digression here, footnote. Justice Thomas is not the only person at the Supreme Court, of course, who has been elevated by, you know, sort of group, you know, by a calculation, you know, sort of a group favoritism. I think, for instance, of Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And here's a nice California story. We're in California. Who put Sandra Day O'Connor on the Supreme Court? Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, who said that he was against affirmative action. Against affirmative action, against affirmative action. He's running for President of the United States. He says, listen, if I'm made President of the United States, I will put a woman on the Supreme Court. And he follows through. He does. He engaged in affirmative action. In the footnote. Now, you ask about Justice Clarence Thomas's claim that the Constitution of the United States is colorblind. What do I say about that? I say a bunch of things. First of all, I say, well, Justice Thomas, you yourself, in your own jurisprudence, don't really believe that. We can point to another California case. A number of years ago, there was a case in California. Johnson versus California was a case that involved the question of whether California authorities should be able to take race into account in separating prisoners. So it was the case that when you went to prison for the first period of, you know, for a period of time, the prison officials would separate people in prison. And they did this because they thought, well, they're prison gangs. A lot of times these prison gangs are racial in character to protect the prisoners, to protect the officers, correction officers. They would segregate the prisoners for a period of time. A prisoner challenged this, goes to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court says, we don't know about this. They remanded the case and said, this has got to be examined, and said, in order for the state authorities to do this, they would have to put forward an extraordinary justification. There were two dissenters in the case who said, no, under these circumstances, it's perfectly okay for the California authorities to racially segregate the prisoners. Who were the two dissenters in the case? Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas. He was taking race into account. And in fact, if you take a look, he says, of course, he doesn't really believe that public authorities ought not be able to ever take race into account. What he really believes is they oughtn't be able to take race into account except for really strong reasons. Well, frankly, I'm willing to say, okay, you give me that, fine. I think we have really strong reasons. I think we have an ongoing emergency in the United States with respect to race. Why isn't rectifying the ongoing effects of racial oppression in the past, why isn't that an extraordinary reason? Why isn't seeking to integrate all of our key institutions, making it clear to all that despite our past, all of our institutions are open to all comers? Why is it showing that in the most vivid way? Why isn't that a sufficient justification for affirmative action? Why isn't the idea of countering the ongoing racial discrimination in American life? We all know there's racial discrimination in American life. We all know that people of color, day in and day out, face an invisible wind of racial discrimination. Why is it countering that a strong enough justification, even under your theory, Justice Thomas? So that's some of what I would say. There's more, but
I like it.
I think that's suffice.
Thank you. I am an affirmative action beneficiary, and I was admitted to Stanford Law School with less than stellar LSAT score. And when I was in law school, I sometimes felt that the white students saw me and my fellow classmates who were black and Latino as inferior. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes felt that, along with my black and Latino classmates, that some of us, we really thought that we were inferior or felt that way. And I spent countless hours telling myself that I was, in fact, good enough. And I was. Mm-hmm. So you have an interesting take in the book on the testing gap, mm-hmm, as it pertains to people of color and about the stigmatizing effect of affirmative action. Will you talk to us just briefly about that?
Sure. First, let's start with that last word that you use, stigmatizing effect, because this is one of the things we were just talking about, Justice Thomas. Justice Thomas is by far the most vociferous opponent of affirmative action at the Supreme Court, by far. And one of the things that he says, and it's very personal with him, he feels, and he's very afraid of the stigmatizing effect of affirmative action. Now, I said at the outset that affirmative action does have costs. It does. And stigma is one of them. You talked about your experience. Well, we can shake hands on that. When I applied to Yale Law School, and I talked about this in the book, when the admissions director from Yale Law School came to Princeton, I waited till all other students had asked their questions, and then I sidled up to them and I said, "Hey, listen. On this little sheet you handed out, my LSAT score is not on it. It's not on the sheet. I'm off the charts in a bad direction." And he said, well, you know, do you have good grades? I said, oh, yeah, I've got really good grades. I have really good grades, but I didn't do very. And he said, apply. I'm quite sure that affirmative action helped me get in. Maybe I would have gotten in anyway, but affirmative action helped. And I'd say this, a couple things. First, with respect to stigma, yes, it's there, and it has remained there. 2 weeks ago, I began my 29th season at Harvard Law School. I teach first-year contracts. Wonderful students, 80 hard-charging, smart, ambitious students. I got up in the class, front of the class. On that very first day, when I get up, I have no doubt that among the 80 students, there are going to be a number of students, by the way, of all racial backgrounds, who are saying to themselves the following. This guy Kennedy, is he a real Harvard Law School professor? Or is he a good, but somewhat lesser, affirmative action Harvard Law School professor? I have no doubt that they're thinking that. Now, is that a cost? Sure, that's a cost. I mean, it's a cost. I feel it. It's a, you know, I mean, I feel an extra, frankly, an extra bit of pressure on me. I think it's a cost for all concerned. I think there are other costs with affirmative action. But, again, I think that the benefits outweigh the cost. One last thing on Justice Thomas. There are some people who really get down on him. I mentioned this, but I didn't follow through with the logic before. There are some people who think that because he's has been a beneficiary of affirmative action, he's morally obligated to support it. I do not agree with that. I do not agree with the proposition that because you are a beneficiary of some sort of program, you are obligated to defend it. There are millions of white people in the United States who are beneficiaries of Jim Crow segregation and of other sorts of white privilege. And fortunately, there are millions of white people who have repudiated that. Just because you've been a beneficiary of a program doesn't mean that you've got to support it. If the program is bad, immoral, you should repudiate it. So I don't think that Justice Thomas, because he's a beneficiary of affirmative action, has to support it. I think he ought to support it because I think on balance it has been good for the United States. But I don't think he should support it simply because it's, you know, been a benefit to him.
What about his trying to tear it down, though? Trying to just get rid of it?
I think, you know, I disagree with him. I disagree with him. And I think that the best way of handling these sorts of arguments is to say, I disagree with Justice Thomas for this reason, this reason, this reason, and this reason. Not to attack Justice Thomas as a race traitor. Not to say, gosh, you know, you're a hypocrite. No, I think that that's not the way to go. I think that the way to go is simply to say you're wrong for reasons that, you know, and set forth the reasons.
I've been collecting cards from you all, and I will be asking some questions in just a moment. But there was one comment on one I'm just going to read to you, and at the end of this question, and it was, I too am an affirmative action baby, but it's just an entree. You still have to do the work. It's not a free ride.
Yep.
Interesting comment. So I'm going to ask.
Can I say one more thing?
Absolutely.
And this gets your experience. I don't think, by the way, so I think for students at elite institutions, students of color, I think a lot of attention is paid to saying to students of color, you know, you belong here, don't for a minute think that you're lesser than your colleagues, etc. When I talk to first-year students at my institution, Harvard, I say, well, you know, the story varies. Some of you are, you know, superior to some of your colleagues. Some of you are better prepared than some of your colleagues. But that's not the case with some of you. some of you are not as well prepared as some of your colleagues. I mean, after all, affirmative action is a boost. I mean, if nobody needed a boost, we wouldn't need affirmative action. In my own experience, have I been at places at which I was actually not as well prepared as some of my colleagues? Answer, yes. But on your point, that was on day one. That was on day one. I don't think there's any disgrace for anybody saying, my education up to this point, not as strong as a colleague's. You're stronger at this point. What you do is, I think it's very helpful to recognize your weaknesses. No, I'm not as well prepared as this person over here. Nope. But I'm going to be as well prepared. In fact, I'm going to, on the 50th day, or maybe the 500th day, I'm going to have caught up. And I think that's fine. I think that's fine. So I tell students, don't be afraid of recognizing your deficiencies. In fact, you want to recognize your deficiencies so that they're not deficiencies anymore.
So I'm going to ask one quick question. I need a one-minute response, and then I'm going to go to your questions. And here is the question. Should President Obama have the opportunity to appoint one or two justices to the Supreme Court, whom should he consider? And what about you? What about me? No.
I would love for President Obama to choose strong, progressive jurists. And I would like for him to push the envelope a bit more with respect to his judicial nominations. There's a particular person, by the way, right here in California, who I would be delighted to see him nominate. I think she's on the faculty at Stanford Law School. Pamela Carlin, I think, would be a great choice. And there are other progressive jurists, and I would like to see him seriously consider some of them.
Thank you. I'm going to turn to your questions now. I apologize in advance for not being able to ask all of these in the time allotted, so I'm trying to get them into categories so I can cover as many as possible. All right, Professor Kennedy, why do Americans seem to be okay with gender-based preferences but not race-based ones?
Great one. It was a wonderful question. Because affirmative action comes in a wide variety of flavors. In my home state in Massachusetts, for instance, there's a very strong affirmative action policy for veterans. And veterans have a tremendous advantage with respect to civil service that tremendously disadvantages women, by the way. I mean, there was a Supreme Court case about that. In-state students versus out-of-state students. There are all sorts of preferencing schemes. Why is it that it's the racial preferencing that generates the hand-wringing, the fighting, there's sort of a special contentiousness? As with things racial, I think there's a paradox here. There's the good, there's a good, and there's a real bad. Let's start with the good. The good is that racial distinctions generate a special anxiety. Why do they generate a special anxiety? They generate a special anxiety because of our history of racial slavery, our history of racial segregation. And so I think that there are some people who don't like affirmative action, don't like any racial distinctions, because it triggers for them the fear generated by racial slavery, racial segregation. I differ with them with respect to the affirmative action issue, but they are not racist, they are anti-racist, and they think that affirmative action goes the wrong way. I differ with them, but they are not racist, and that's one of the that's sort of their take. And that's a good story. I mean, one of the good things that happened with the Civil Rights Revolution was the stigmatizing of invidious racial discrimination, and they make the mistake of thinking that affirmative action is a type of invidious racial discrimination. I think there's a mistake, but I understand that the feeling animating the mistake comes from a good place. But there is another thing going on in America, and that is that there are an appreciable number of Americans, frankly a substantial number, who don't like affirmative action. Why? Because they perceive affirmative action as advancing the fortunes of people of color, and they don't like it. They, frankly, are racist. And oftentimes, that part of the story gets, you know, sort of denied. You talk about affirmative action, people say, well, we're all after the same thing, we just differ on means. No, we're not all after the same thing. I'm sorry. It'd be good if we were, but we're not. And one of the things, and here, you know, I said, let's go to a little bit of history. Let's go back to the nation's first civil rights statute, federal civil rights statute. The nation's first civil rights, federal civil rights statute was the Civil Rights Act of 1866. The Civil Rights Act of 1866 was the federal statute that made all persons, provided that all persons born in the United States would be citizens of the United States, and provided that all persons would have the same rights as whites to own property, to enter into contracts, to sue and be sued, to testify in court, the classic civil rights. Andrew Johnson, President Andrew Johnson, the successor to Abraham Lincoln, vetoed the Civil Rights Act of 1866. Why? Because in his view it gave, and this is a direct quote, quote, discriminating protection to the Negro. In 1866, with the abolition of slavery by the 13th Amendment being less than 1 year old, even then, there was the talk of reverse discrimination. And by the way, that trope, that talk, has been in American life ever since. In 1964, next summer, we will celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. If you go back and take a look at the fighting over the 1964 Civil Rights Act, what will you see? You will see Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina. You will see Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina attacking Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act as a type of reverse discrimination. This is a trope that has been with us. It has been used time and time and time again by people, frankly, who did not want to see people of color advance. That has been part of our history, and unfortunately, it is still part of the American racial story. It's not the whole story, but it is still part of the story.
I must tell you that I am so envious of the students in your class, because I listen to you talk and I'm just mesmerized, and I hope they appreciate the very benefit they have of sitting in your classroom. I'm going to take this moment to remind our audience that this is the Commonwealth Club of California. And we're talking to Randall Kennedy, professor of law at Harvard Law School and the author of his latest book, For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. I am Ladaris Hazard Cordell, and I'm pleased to serve as the moderator for today's program. You can hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and watch video of the programs online at Fora, F-O-R-A-TV. All right, back to our questions. This audience is mostly white. Does that surprise you?
Well, I mean, demographics being what demographics are, no. I'm not surprised.
Okay. How do you feel about the burden of representing African Americans or the black race? Do you feel that it's a burden? And if so, how do you feel about it?
Yes, I think that there is a burden. I recognize that, frankly, no matter what I say, I mean, if I said I didn't want the burden or I wanted the burden, it wouldn't matter. I mean, you know, people are looking. People of all sorts are looking. And I think what happens typically is that you are viewed, whatever you say, as a type of representative. People do generalize. And do I feel that to be, you know, do I feel that to be a burden? Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, with friends, black and white, and in between, and, you know, Native American and Asian American, you know, we joke about it. You know, you're in class, you know, representing the race. One of the most vivid memories I have in law school, never forget this, tax class, second year, Boris Bittker's tax class, I'll never forget this. On the very first day of class, Boris Bittker called, his first person he called on was a fellow student, a woman, a black woman student, called on her. It was the first person. I don't know if I was imagining things or not, but I remember feeling that everything got really quiet. Truly, you could hear the proverbial pin drop. And I clearly remember thinking to myself, please answer this question well.
Don't mess up.
Don't let the race down. And I remember, and she really answered, showed total mastery of the subject. And I remember this, part of the reason I remember this, because I remember after class, I mean, there weren't very many, you know, I went, you know, there were probably three black people in the class, but I remember talking to people about it. And I asked people, I said, you know, hey, I'm going to tell you how I felt, and I want to know how you felt. I felt nervous. Did you feel nervous? I mean, yes. Yes. I was, come on, sis. Answer the question well. Because, you know, folks are watching. And, you know, if you mess up, people, you know, well, what do you expect? And see, there you go. That's what happens. And so, you know, when I'm a teacher, again, when I'm a teacher, or for that matter, you know, let's make it real. Here, now, do I feel that it's incumbent upon me to represent? Sure. And in that sense, I think that I feel it's incumbent on all Americans to do their bit to help us overcome our racial trauma. White people are burdened in various ways. We're talking about affirmative action. Does affirmative action to some degree limit opportunities of white people? I'm willing to say yes. Yes, it does. And that is part of white people's burden. I don't think it's unjust. I think it's a burden, but it's not an unjust burden. And are black people called upon to shoulder a burden in order to help us overcome our racial trauma? Again, yes, sure. This is part of it.
Are there ways to measure the success of an affirmative action program, and if so, how?
Sure, and people have. I mentioned William G. Bowen, former president of Princeton University. Bill Bowen and Derek Bach wrote a book a number of years ago about affirmative action. in which they, you know, they ask questions. Oh, we've had affirmative action at various institutions. What has happened? What have these people, you know, the beneficiaries of affirmative action, like me, what have they done? What, you know, what is their perception of what they've done? What is an objective measurement of what they've done? Have they gone on to become doctors and lawyers and other things? Have they influenced things? What about their white classmates? What do their white classmates say? So yeah, this has been investigated, and not only has it been investigated in terms, you know, and sort of through sort of a sociological analysis, I actually put a lot of store by impressions. I think that qualitative impressions are quite important. And I think that actually over the past, what, 5 or 6 years, the United States of America has been in the grip of an important experiment that is deeply related to our subject. What is that experiment? It's a rather remarkable experiment in the history of the world. In the history of the world. We are a former slave society. We had racial slavery. ...1865 is not all that long ago. And in the United States of America, over the past 5 years, we have had at the helm of our government a person who identifies himself as a black American. What, I mean, concretely, for the past 5 years, a black American has had his finger on the nuclear trigger. Think about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the nuclear trigger. The commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the United States has been within the safekeeping of an African American. Now, I think psychologically that's a very important thing. Put all of, you know, Obamacare and all this other stuff, yeah, I'm sure it's very important, but I think psychologically the fact of a black American being at the apex of power in America is psychologically very important. I do not think that that would have been possible but for the policy that we're talking about today. I think that affirmative action in its various, I mean, in its various guises, affirmative action in all sorts of places, in workplaces, in educational institutions, in entertainment, boards of trustees, prizes. One of the things that affirmative action has done has been simply to, you know, break a psychological barrier. You go to graduations. You go to graduations, and at graduations you see people who mount the stage in the, you know, institutions. You know, University of California at various, University of California at Riverside, University of California at Berkeley, University of California at Davis, University of California, various places. You know, graduation. These universities have give out honorary degrees to people who they think are worthy. And for a long time in American life, you know, you'd go to graduation, you wouldn't see people of color. No, year after year after year, wouldn't see nobody of color. Then change. You started seeing people of color. So that now,
Now you go to a graduation, you're not, you know, a person of color. No big deal. You applaud. It's a, you know, it's a wonderful thing. These are very accomplished people. But you don't think twice about seeing them. Every year since Lyndon Johnson, there has been a person of color in the cabinet, the President of the United States. Prior to Lyndon Johnson, pure white male monopoly. Nobody even talked much about it. You know, if you had gone back in time, you know, 90 years ago, and had asked somebody, gosh, there's no person of color in the cabinet. Person talking with you would have looked at you sort of funny. No. And what of it? Since Lyndon Johnson, there has been an unspoken quota. Even presidents who said that they were against affirmative action made sure there were some people of color in the cabinet. If Patrick Buchanan had become president of the United States, he'd have found somebody black to put up in the cabinet. Why? For a good reason, a good thing that Americans should be proud of. Because there is a widespread feeling, even on the part of people who say they're against affirmative action, there is a widespread feeling, you know, we can't have key institutions of American life in which, you know, big sectors of the American population are just absent. It's intolerable. We can't have that. Which is why, no matter what the Supreme Court says, the affirmative action ethos will continue.
We probably have time maybe for two questions, but probably just one more before we wrap up. More personal one.
Okay.
Who inspired you, parents aside, who inspired you when you were growing up?
You said parents aside.
Yes.
Okay. Because I mean, first and foremost, it'd be my parents. I feel very lucky. Rachel and Henry Kennedy. And I feel incredibly fortunate. I think I've lived a very charmed life. And starting off with my parents, great people. Absent my parents, I'll pick a person who I heard about all the time when I was growing up. And it was a great thrill for me to be able to work for him, Thurgood Marshall. And the way I heard about Thurgood Marshall was an interesting thing. My father went to see Thurgood Marshall argue a case before the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in South Carolina. It was the last of the white primary cases, Rice versus Elmore. Rice versus Elmore. Back in those days, in South Carolina, of course, the Democratic Party ruled completely. And so whoever won the Democratic primary won the election. And black people were not allowed to vote in the Democratic primary. So this was a challenge to the exclusion of black people from the Democratic primary. Thurgood Marshall argued the case. And when I was growing up, my father remarked about this all the time. My father did not know very much about the legal issues involved in the case. So he didn't talk about the legal issues involved in the case. When I went to law school, I learned about the legal issues involved in the case. But my father did not talk about that. The thing that struck my father the most, and the thing that he talked about, was as follows. He said that in that courtroom, it was quite clear that the most distinguished person in that courtroom was Thurgood Marshall. And he talked about what the lawyers and what the judges called Thurgood Marshall. And to show you how terrible Jim Crow system was, the thing that stuck in my father's mind the most was that Thurgood Marshall was called Mr. Marshall. The fact that he was called Mr. was a big deal, because back in those days, black men were not referred to as Mr. If you were a minister, they might call you Reverend.
And under Jim Crow etiquette, you could call a black doctor, doctor. But you did not call a black man mister. That was just foreign to Jim Crow etiquette. But Mr. Civil Rights was so distinguished. He was so, frankly, superior that even in that setting, he was deferred to. And it was, you know, that's one of the reasons why, you know, when I got a job working for Mr. Civil Rights,
that's right.
It was one of the great thrills of my life.
Thank you. Well, we have come to the point in our program where we're going to wrap it up. And usually we ask one final question. We're not going to do that. Instead, I think the most fitting way to end our program today is to ask Professor Kennedy, if you will, to read us the final passage of your book on the very last page. And I think that's the best way to end. So if you'll do us the honors.
Okay. While there's nothing wrong with expressing a hope that one day special measures on behalf of marginalized groups will no longer be essential, anxiety about an endpoint should not be allowed to stymie the continued deployment of affirmative action for as long as it is needed to accomplish the wide variety of important missions that it serves. Throughout American history, there has surfaced repeatedly a regrettable tendency to underestimate the power of racism's influence and to bring to an end too soon promising interventions. Largely because of the consequences wrought by biases, one may hope but not firmly forecast that over the next generation's span, progress toward non-discrimination and genuinely equal opportunity will make it safe to sunset affirmative action. Ending it prematurely would be a calamity. So I hope we don't end it prematurely. Thank you.
Thank you, Randall Kennedy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our thanks to Randall Kennedy, the professor of law at Harvard Law School and author of For Discrimination, Race, Affirmative Action, and the Law. We also thank our audience here and on radio, television, and on the Internet. I am Ladaris Hazard Cordell, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are always in the know, is adjourned. Thank you all. Mm-hmm.